Now I'm going to talk about Franken frogs. And actually, I'm using the term frog simply because it's alliterative. In reality, we're going to talk about Frankenmanders, because salamanders are really the subject of this research, which is titled Self-Organization, the Amphibian Limb Regeneration Blastoma. Well, the objectives that I want to pursue this morning are to describe the process of limb regeneration in amphibians, show experimentally that the limb regeneration blastoma is a self-organizing system, present experiments indicating that amputated positional identities, which I'll explain later, are restored by cell interactions within boundaries that outline what is to be regenerated. Then I want to present an idea, if there's time, of how the proximal and distal boundaries of the regenerant are established, and then present some experiments showing that positional identity is expressed on the cell surface. These are the players in in this drama. This is a newt, and these arrows simply point to all the different kinds of things that these animals can regenerate. They are morphogenetic magicians. They can regenerate upper and lower jaws. They can regenerate the lens of the eye, the neural retina of the eye, the spinal cord, tissue of the heart, and all four limbs and the tail too. And this is simply another animal that's very popular in regeneration studies. It's the Mexican salamander, the axolotl, Angistoma mexicanum. We used to have the colony for these at Indiana University, and we very stupidly let it go to the University of Kentucky. Okay, I want to show you here the actual process of limb regeneration. Up here is how it appears from the outside. Just look, an external view of limb regeneration. This is a very famous photo by Richard J. Goss that he published in his 1969 book, Principles of Regeneration. And what this shows is an animal here that has had the left limb amputated through the middle of the lower forearm, the radius and ulna. And on the right here is a limb that's been amputated through the middle of the upper arm, or the humerus. And what you see happening here, if we just follow this, is that after about 2 weeks in this newt, this adult newt, you see a little translucent bud of tissue appear at the end of the limb, at the amputation surface, and that grows.
Question?
And yes.
So these pictures are all the same limb of the same animal at different times?
No, this is two different animals. This is one animal here and one animal here.
Each size.
No, but
each
when
size.
I look at the different things going down,
yes.
Are those just different times?
Oh, these are different times.
Same limb
I'm
from
sorry.
The same
yes. Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Time lapse film here.
Okay. Okay. But from the same animal. Going down.
No, this is it could be from the same animal because you just put this on this side and this on this side. Okay, so this grows, and it begins to change shape. So here you see it bending, it's flattening out, then it bends, and that bend indicates a new elbow joint. Then the end of it notches up, that indicates the appearance of the first couple of digits, and then the other digits appear, and then finally you can see that this has the morphological shape of the original limb, and that will grow and produce an exact phenocopy of what was removed. And it's perfectly functional. Okay, this is in the axolotl, and this shows longitudinal sections of a limb that's regenerating after being amputated through the distal humerus of the forearm. This is 2 days after the amputation. And what you see here is that a wound epidermis grows over the tip of the limb. That's the first thing that happens. That happens within hours after the amputation. By 2 days, you see these multinucleated, very large cells arranged around this periosteal bone shell that surrounds the cartilage of this humerus. And those cells are called osteoclasts. And they are monsters. They produce hydrochloric acid, they produce matrix metalloproteinases, and their job is to degrade the non-organic or mineral matrix of that periosteal bone shell and get rid of it. So they'll be punching holes in that periosteal bone. Then you see, by 4 days...
Wait, can I have a quick question? Periosteal bone, that means like the bone that was cut in the amputation?
No. Here, periosteal bone is this thin shell of bone that surrounds this internal cartilage. That's the way these skeletal structures are in these animals. They're internal core cartilage, bone on the outside.
So why does it want to get rid of that?
Well, I'll show you in a moment.
Okay.
So what's happening here at 4 days is that you see a little mass of cells accumulating under the wound epidermis. And these cells are very intensely synthesizing DNA, RNA, and protein, and they are called blastema cells. They are essentially undifferentiated cells. They have the appearance of mesenchymal cells, and their origin happens to be from the cartilage tissue, from the muscle tissue, and from the dermal connective tissue underneath the epidermis. What is happening here is that all of these different cell types, differentiated cell types, are being liberated by a process of dissolution of the matrix that normally encloses them. And that process of matrix degradation is accomplished, again, by matrix metalloproteinases and also acid hydrolases, releasing the cells, and the cells then undergo a process of dedifferentiation. So muscle, which loses its contractile apparatus, chondrocytes assume the same shape as these muscle cells, all of them revert back to this mesenchymal cell type.
So that blastema is formed of these dedifferentiated cells.
Dedifferentiated cells.
Are there stem cells in the bowl?
Yes, there are. These animals have the usual mesenchymal stem cells in the periosteum of the bone, usual satellite cells in the muscle. The next question is, do they contribute? The answer is nobody knows.
But if you, the role of bone stem cells, because that seems to be where a lot of our stem cells come from in this particular business.
Yeah.
If you did some damage that didn't include cutting the bone,
right,
would you get the same thing?
If you don't amputate, if you fracture the bone, it repairs just like our bones using those mesenchymal stem cells. If you tear a muscle without amputation, that muscle is repaired by satellite cells. Okay, so this situation here is specific to an amputated limb. So these cells are dividing very rapidly. Yeah.
So when you say a variety of different cells undifferentiate, is it clear that the outcome is the same? That is to say, is the muscle cell that differentiated exactly the same as the others, so they get to the same place, or do they have different potential once they're undifferentiated?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It turns out that the ones from the dermis are actually able to form cartilage. And the muscle cells aren't so plastic as those cells. So they retain some of their original features. I would say this dedifferentiation process renders them morphologically similar. Yeah.
And these are sections stained for DNA? Is that what
we're talking about? No. These sections are stained with hematoxylin and eosin, which will allow you to see nuclei and cytoplasm.
So the same growth pattern, regardless of where you cut your limb.
Whether you cut through a finger, through the wrist, through
right.
the upper arm,
right.
yeah, you get a blastema form.
And then it grows.
Yeah. So this is the shows at 7 days how this is grown by mitosis, and you still see these osteoclasts hanging around here, this dedifferentiation process continues for some time, and about here is where, or just after this stage is where it cuts off. We call this commonly the cone stage. Then you see the internal changes taking place that indicate that this blastema is reconstituting the missing limb parts, and you can see these cartilage condensations appearing here, here. This is for the radius and ulna. This is for the carpals, and out here for the digits. 12 days, this becomes much more apparent. You now see this notched structure, and here are the first two digits of the limb. Here is the third digit, and the fourth one is right over here. Here are carpals. Radius and ulna would be back here, and new humerus here. Now we've switched from longitudinal sections here at 14 days to a different method of staining. These are hole mounts now, where you stain the whole regenerating structure with a dye called methylene blue, which binds to aggregin in the cartilage matrix. And now you can see the cartilages in their entirety. So here's the newly regenerated humerus, radius, ulna, the carpals, and the digits, which are the least well stained. And by 3 weeks, here's the phenocopy. This is the skeleton stained in the same way. I just want to name these parts. This upper part here, we call this a stylopodium. We call the next segment a zygapodium. And then I'm just going to call everything from here on the autopodium. The specifics of that in a forelimb are humerus, radius, and ulna, carpals, and then phalanges. And of course, in the hind limb, the counterparts are going to be femur, tibia, and fibula, tarsals, metatarsals, and phalanges.
The scaps are only artifacts in staining. The scaps in the bones are only artifacts.
These, the little dots. No.
The way it looks like the bones have big gaps.
Oh, here.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's where ossification is beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The actual process of bone formation. This is all cartilage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the descriptive description of limb regeneration. Now, these blastema stem cells, I'm going to call them stem cells, require survival and proliferation factors from both ingrowing nerves, which start coming back into this regeneration blastema within 2 days after the amputation. They also require factors from that overlying wound epidermis. So here are the general kinds of experiments which demonstrate that. If you simply amputate a limb, and then you denervate it immediately by making an incision up here at the shoulder. You go in, you can see the three brachial nerves that innervate the arm, you can cut those. That effectively denervates the limb. If you want to remove the epidermis or prevent epidermal contact immediately after amputation, what's been done is to amputate the limb and then sort of pare back the cartilage and muscle and put a flap full thickness skin over the tip of the limb so that it never contacts that epidermis. One of the things that I should have said here, if you look at this, there's no basement membrane between that epidermis and the underlying mesenchymal stem cells, blastema cells. That basement membrane is missing, and that means you can have direct contact between the epidermal cells and the underlying blastema cells. That's absolutely required for regeneration. As a matter of fact, most of you probably know, you can regenerate the adults. We can regenerate the tips of our fingers. But we can only do that if the wound is not sutured shut. And that's what surgeons always used to do. Suture the wound shut so you're missing the tip of the finger, but if you leave the wound open so that the epidermis crawls over it, that finger regenerates, the fingertip regenerates.
Even bone at the fingertip? Could you cut off pieces of bone?
Yeah, you cut off the tip of the phalange. Now, it won't work back here. It's only the part of the finger distal to the last phalangeal joint. Works for toes, too. This is good for... It's good for lawnmower accidents. So anyway, those two operations prevent blastema formation entirely. So you might ask, why? Is it because the cells don't undergo dedifferentiation? No, they do. The problem is that they won't proliferate, and they die by apoptosis. Now, what this shows is that you can, if you wait until the blastema has achieved a cone stage of regeneration, where there are lots and lots of blastema cells, and then you denervate, that blastema will actually undergo morphogenesis into a proximal distally complete regenerate. And you can do the same thing with a cone stage blastema. If you get rid of the epidermis, you soak this in a mild solution of EDTA, which is a calcium ion chelator, and that loosens up the epidermis and you can peel it off. Now you take those blastema cells and you make a tunnel in the dorsal fin of the animal and use that tunnel as a culture chamber. So you can stick this blastema in there so it doesn't contact any epidermis at all, or you can put it in there so that the very tip of it sticks out of the tunnel and it gets recovered by fin epidermis. Well, when you completely enclose it, you get this. You get this truncated, distally truncated pattern. Here you get a stylopodium, there's the zeugopodium, and then just the beginnings of the autopodium, and that's it. No digits, nothing. But if you let the fin epidermis recover the tip of it when it's stuck out of the tunnel, look what you get. Proximal, distally complete pattern. Now, every single one of these, whether it's this, this, or this, is a miniature. It's not a full-sized regenerate. And the reason that it's a miniature is because mitosis essentially stops when you either denervate this limb or you remove the epidermis. But there are enough cells at that point where that blastema can do its morphogenetic thing and form a complete regenerate, except for this. And this suggests that in addition to this outgrowth promoting function that the epidermis has, it also has some kind of role in the proximal distal patterning of this regenerate. Does everybody know of axes? This is proximal to distal, from the shoulder down to the fingertips, anterior posterior from the thumb to the little finger, dorsal and ventral from the extensor muscles on the top to the flexor muscles on the palm side of the hand. Okay.
Wait, sorry, can you explain one more time the difference between the experiments on the bottom?
Yes.
It doesn't have the epidermis, it can't.
Neither of them have the epidermis, but in this case, this is fully enclosed within the fin tunnel so that it cannot recontact epidermis.
Got it.
In this case, the distal tip is sticking out so that it can.
I see.
Okay? Well, what are these factors that are produced by this apical epidermal cap? That's this thickened wound epidermis over the tip of the blastema and the nerves. Well, there have been hundreds of experiments done to ferret this out, and this slide just summarizes these. The wound epidermis, thickened wound epidermis up here, produces at least four FGF members. So it's FGF 1, 2, 8, and 10. The nerves produce FGF2, but they also produce something called neuroregulin or glial growth factor 2, and they produce the iron binding protein transferrin and a neurotransmitter called substance P. And it turns out that the blastema cells themselves also produce FGF. M here stands for muscle, H here stands for humerus. And it turns out also some of these will actually substitute for the nerves or the epidermis, particularly in vitro. You can put them in and you can increase the rate of mitosis of the cultured blastema cells by putting these molecules in. Okay, patterning. Well, the big question, at least for me, the one I've always been interested in, how does this conical mass of cells pattern itself into this very complex new arm or leg? That's the question. So there are two possibilities here, and one of them was in vogue up until the late 1960s. And this one said, well, this mass of blastema cells is right next to these differentiated tissues. So it's logical then that chemical signals from these differentiated tissues form gradients that tell this mass of cells what to do, how to pattern themselves. The other alternative is that all the information that's required to form this complex structure is contained within the confines of the blastema itself. Okay? And that would mean it requires no signals from the adjacent differentiated tissues to pattern. It ought to be able to pattern on its own, be a self-organizing system, that is. So how do you test this? Well, you can graft early whole or fractions of blastemas to ectopic sites to see how they'll perform away from those differentiated tissues. Graft early forelimb blastemas to hindlimb amputation surface and vice versa. Can you change a forelimb blastema into a hindlimb regenerate and vice versa? Graft an early distal blastema to a proximal amputation surface and vice versa. Can you now make that blastema form more structures than it would normally form or less structures than it would normally form? Or reverse the transverse axes of the early blastema, reverse the polarity of the blastema with respect to the differentiated limb tissues. Now can you reverse the normal polarity of that blastema?
So in kind of this patterning, you're including how it knows where the amputation was. Should it grow part of a limb or a whole limb?
Right, and also whether to form a forelimb or a hindlimb, what axial patterning to have, all of those things, whether it be a right limb, a left limb, so forth. Okay, so here's what you do. This grid shows several of these kinds of ectopic grafting operations. If you cut here, you cut off the whole blastema, and you can graft that to a non-limb location. You can cut the blastema in half, you can graft the distal half, you can graft the proximal half in the same way. You can divide the blastema longitudinally into halves or thirds or quarters if you're really good enough, and then graft these longitudinal pieces of the blastema to an ectopic site.
What is actual size scale in that picture?
Oh, okay, another good question. These are small larvae. Their total length is probably no more than 60 to 80 millimeters. So these limbs are, they're pretty small, okay? The blastemas, I would say, may be 1 millimeter in diameter and no more than 1 or 2 millimeters long.
That whole cone.
Right, this thing. So in the way you're doing these operations, what you're using is the kinds of scissors that eye surgeons use. They're very small, they're very sharp, and they're very pointed on the end. And you use watchmaker's forceps. So. On a dissecting microscope to blow it up times 20, times 50. And the operation is
done. So if you get someone in your lab who's good at this, you try to keep them forever?
you don't let them get their PhD.
Okay.
Okay, so this shows an ectopic grafting operation, grafting a whole blastema. And what you see here is this is 4 days after the operation. One of those cone stage blastemas was grafted to the dorsal fin. Now this is the body of the animal down here, and the dorsal fin, of course, sticks up from that. So this animal is lying on its side in order to take this picture. And what's been done is you go in with watchmaker's forceps and you just rip off a patch of skin from the dorsal fin. Then what you do is that you scratch the blood vessels and you make this wound site bleed and let it get sticky for a couple of minutes and then stick the blastema right on there. That plasma that comes out of there acts as the glue. And you keep the animal lightly anesthetized for an hour or so, and the edges of the fin wound epidermis will then heal with the edges of the blastema epidermis. You wake the animal up and let it develop. Okay, this is a distal half blastema that's been grafted to the dorsal fin, and it forms a hand only. That indicates that at that stage, that cone stage, the distal half of that cone stage is committed to form hand structures, and the proximal half would then give you everything else. This is a whole blastema that's been grafted with a little bit of stump tissue on it, a little bit of the differentiated tissue, and it develops a complete regenerate in the proximal distal axis.
And would these be the right size? As if they grew with them?
No, they are not the right size. That's another good question, because when you graft them, they're denervated. They have their epidermis, but they're denervated, and you need both that epidermis and the nerves in order to get normal mitosis.
They can't use the nerves from that part of the
They can, but it takes a few days for them to grow, for those nerves to grow in. Yeah.
But it's really stunning that they choose to develop small versions of all the structures rather than just partially develop the,
yes.
the other structure,
yes.
the original structure.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what.
How color?
Okay, let's see. Anybody up there now?
How recent are these experiments? Is this like classical developmental biology that everybody knows and we're just shocked?
Well, these are experiments that I did in the late 1960s, 1970s. What you're going to be seeing here is a lot of experiments right up to the end of the 1980s, okay? And then I took a job as a dean in a school of science, and I was there at that job for 15 years. I'm fully recovered now, and so I'm going to show you then some plans for new experiments. This picture hasn't come out well, unfortunately, but really what it shows is this without the differentiated tissues. It's a whole blastema, it's this one, that develops pretty much perfectly out of the dorsal fin. Now this last one is kind of interesting. It's very hard to split one of these blastemas exactly in half. And this one, I managed to split it into one third and two thirds. What's very interesting here is this is the anterior one-third, and that anterior one-third forms exactly one digit, plus associated carpals, plus one of the zygapodial elements. The two-thirds here forms the other three digits, number two, three, and four, the other zygapodial element, and the rest of the carpals. So you know, the fraction of the blastema that's grafted is approximately what you get. Okay, well somebody could say, well wait a minute, all right, you're grafting these at this conical stage. How do you know that that blastema hasn't already received instructions from the adjacent differentiated tissues, and those instructions are simply being expressed now at this ectopic site? So we had to devise a way to take care of that, and the idea was, all right, we're going to make this thing basically start right at the very beginning. So this was an experiment done by Doug Melton, who's now chairman of biochemistry and molecular biology at Harvard. And he did this as an undergraduate student when we were both at the University of Illinois. The experiment was this. You amputate the limb where the big arrow is here, and then let it grow out till it's starting to redifferentiate. This is a four limb. And then what you do is you cut off, there are cartilage condensations just beginning to form here. You cut off the distal part of that limb, then you take the proximal half of it, and then you graft that to the tarsus of behind the limb, okay? Like this. So this is one of those grafts. This is a proximal half of that upper arm blastema, and it's been grafted to to the tarsus of the hindwing. Now this is an artifact, this tore during sectioning, but you can see this is a very healthy piece of tissue now growing here. But here's
a quick question. The hindwing was also amputated?
The hindwing is amputated, but no blastema formed.
Okay, so
okay.
Right away.
Yeah, it's just the site for the graft. Okay, so this can become vascularized and innervated right from the hindwing tissues. But the thing to notice here is this. This proximal half stops developing. It doesn't go any further in its differentiation. It gets recovered by wound epidermis, and the whole thing just de-differentiates again. De-differentiates. The beauty of the experiment is there's enough cellular mass here to express morphogenetic qualities, but the cells are absolutely undifferentiated as far as we can tell. So we are making this thing start over with regard to de-differentiation. And yet, here's what happens. Here's the host, here's the femur, here is the tibia and the fibula, and here are the tarsi, right here. That's the site of the graft. Look what this graft did, this proximal half of this upper arm blastema. Formed a humerus, a radius and ulna, all four digits and all eight carpals. Perfect morphology. The point that even if you make this thing start completely over, it can self-organize into a forelimb on a hindwing set of differentiated tissues. So you can't change it and even by making it start over. Well, I'm going to summarize in this slide a whole bunch of these kinds, different kinds of experiments. And the bottom line here is that no matter what you do with this blastema, it always develops according to its origin. So you can actually, you can graft it from the right limb to the right forelimb to the right hind limb, and vice versa. And in one case, you can shift its position from distal to proximal. In the other, you can shift it from proximal to distal. Here's the outcome that you get when you put a right hind limb on a right forelimb, a right hind limb blastema, derived by amputation through the femur, out here at the wrist level of the forelimb. You get a complete right hind limb. It's essentially a serially duplicated limb. The other way around, if you put a wrist blastema from the forelimb onto the femur level of the hind limb, that gets filled in by cells from the host level, and you get a normal limb. So this stipple indicates origin from the host level. This white indicates that the graft developed like it would have had it been left in situ. You can also reverse the axes. This shows the anterior-posterior axis. So this is a very easy thing to do. You take a blastema from right forelimb, let's say, and then you just move it over to the left forelimb. You keep the dorsal ventral axes aligned, but that going from right to left reverses the anterior-posterior axis of the blastema with respect to the anterior-posterior axis of the host.
Quick question.
Yeah.
How does this compare to, say, similar experiments in the embryonic salamanders as they sprout limbs if you do the same experiments?
Yeah, there are some real similarities. I'll show you those. You're talking about those old Harrison experiments. Yeah. Here's the similarity. You get supernumerary limbs formed on either side. This is the primary, the graft. Okay, so here is this right forelimb blastema developing as a right forelimb when grafted to this left forelimb. And so that's all from the graft, but then you get two supernumeraries that both have the handedness of the host limb. So these are both left. And those supernumeraries can be derived from varying combinations of host and graft tissue is indicated by the two different colors here. Those are the same kinds of results that Harrison got by reversing axes in embryonic salamanders, limb axes. Okay, so no matter what you do, you can't change the normal fate of this regeneration blastema. Now I want to look more closely at what happens when you do when you graft a blastema from a distal level to a more proximal host level. And also, I want to look more closely at those supernumerary limbs that were formed. Maurice Pascitelli did these experiments, and he wanted to make sure that this graft did develop completely according to origin. In order to prove that, you need some kind of marker. You need to be able to mark the cells. So he made triploid animals, which have three nuclei as opposed to the diploids, which only have two, and then he did statistical counts of nuclei after making these grafts and letting them develop. So here, here was the design of the experiment. Here's the triploid animal. Amputate that through the wrist, derive triploid blastema, and then graft that to the middle of the upper arm of a 2N animal and just discard all of this. So what he found was that indeed he got a normal limb, but the graft cells were all triploid. There was very little mixing right here at this interface. All the other cells of the intermediate structures were intercalated between here and here, and all of those were diploid, all those cells were diploid. So again, he was able to show very clearly that the graft did not change from its origin. It developed according to origin, and that you had this phenomenon called intercalary regeneration between the base of the triploid blastema and the amputation surface of the diploid limb stock. So we're going to call this proximo-distal intercalation. It's very important because this is a boundary, that is a boundary. Okay? Now let's look at these supernumeraries. What is actually happening here when you do this kind of a graft? Well, here's a right limb. Okay, and we're grafting a left blastema onto it. And we're keeping the dorsoventral axes aligned. What that does is confront posterior tissue of the host with anterior tissue of the graft on this side of the screen. And on the other side of the screen, it confronts posterior tissue of the graft with anterior tissue of the host. Now, what are we doing when we do this graft? We're putting together two half circumferences of a limb when we do this. You can imagine if you want to look at a circumference, if you want to put numbers on it, if you want to put letters on it, whatever. But what we're doing here is putting together on this side a posterior half circumference and here an anterior half circumference. Okay? Now, what's going to happen here? It's going to be the same thing that happens when you do this proximal to distal shift. There's a gap in the structure, okay? And when these cells from disparate positions are confronted like that, they recognize the fact that there is a gap. And what they do is dedifferentiate, undergo mitosis, and fill the gap in, okay? That's what they do. And that's what's happening here as well. Two half circumferences, that gap is being filled in radially. Okay, so that you now get, here's the primary limb growing out in this direction. Here's the supernumerary that's coming out of the screen. This is the two half circumferences filled out into a circle by radial intercalation as indicated by these arrows, and the same thing is happening on the other side of the screen, and so you get this left primary regenerant and then two right-handed supernumerary regenerates looking down now from the top. So we're calling this radial intercalation. So the point to take away from this is that this system, anytime there is a structural gap and these cells are able to de-differentiate and they touch one another, they will sense that gap. And that triggers this whole chain of events that results in mitosis and then filling in the missing structures. That's the principle of intercalation. Okay, so I'm going to take this minimal amount of data, there's lots more, but and show you a boundary model for self-organization that's based on intercalary regeneration of cellular positional identities. Now here comes this term again, positional identity. So I want you to think of the limb as a three-dimensional map of cells. Each one of those cells knows its position within that three-dimensional space. It also knows who the neighbors next to it are. So this, we call this a normal neighbor map. This is what Jay Mittenthal described in 1981. And if any of the neighbors are removed, the others will try to bring them back. Okay. So this is the model. It's very simple. I actually developed this in 1980. It was published in Developmental Biology. I've modified it since then. But basically it's this. Here's a cone stage blastema. And it's it's able to intercalate in three ways. What I'm going to say is I'm going to hypothesize that normal regeneration involves intercalation of missing positional identities between a distal boundary and a proximal boundary. So that's indicated by this arrow right here. This is intercalation in the radial direction for when you form a supernumerary limb. That's not required immediately after amputation of a normal limb because the whole cross-sectional set of positional identities is there. You can also cut out pieces of the circumference and intercalation will occur circumferentially. Anywhere there's a gap, it's going to intercalate the missing structures. One thing to note out here at the tip is this tip, you know, it's conical, it tapers at the end. So there are many fewer cells out here at the tip than there are back here at the base. And that means that you've got to have, that means that the complete circumference is not present there, nor is the complete radius of the regenerating structures there. And so intercalation has to be going on circumferentially and radially out here to make sure that you maintain that full cross-sectional set of positional identities. That's just a point to keep in mind because it's going to be important in explaining some results that I'm going to show you later. Okay, what is the boundary? First I said it was the epidermis in the 1980 model, but I think I'm going to show you that the epidermis probably plays a role, but I believe it's the shell of blastema cells that lies right underneath and in contact with the epidermis. Those are the bound. That's the outline of what is to be regenerated. And here's a drawing showing this in the proximal distal axis. What I'm proposing just from this axis is at 2 days after amputation, both the proximal boundary and the distal boundary are present. The ends of what are to be regenerated along that axis are present. Then intercalary regeneration fills in the missing positional identities with growth of the blastema. So here's this yellow, there's a green. I can't really, okay. 3 days, it's red and green. Everything is essentially there at that point, and now it's expanding out, so that this is going to form, these two parts are going to form the hand, this is going to form the zoidopodium, this is going to form the stylopodium. This little thing here is called the zone of polarizing activity. It's a signaling center that lies on the posterior side of all limb buds that have been examined so far, and it's also present on the posterior side of a regeneration. So where do these boundaries come from? I proposed the circumferential and the proximal boundary positional identities are simply inherited from parent limb cells as they de-differentiate. This is something called positional memory. Okay, and it might be related to that epigenetic code that we talked about on Monday. The missing piece of the puzzle in this whole model is how is the distal boundary established? It's very easy to see how proximal distal intercalation can take place when you sort of artificially make a distal boundary by grafting a distal blastema to a proximal level. So that's easy to understand. But this, after just simple amputation, it's not so easy to understand how a distal boundary might be reestablished. Okay, so here's some clues. This comes from work of Dave Gardner et al. At Irvine. This was in a 1999 paper. And what they found was that these two transcription factors, HOXA9 and HOXA13 are markers for proximal and distal structures, respectively. Now, in the very early blastema, this is within 2 days after amputation, what they found was that both HOXA13 and HOXA9 were uniformly expressed right here in these cells underneath the wound epidermis. Okay? And then, as the blastema grew, by the cone stage, the expression domains of HOXA9 and HOXA13 separated, so that 13 was expressed distally and 9 was expressed proximally. Now, in reality, 9 is expressed throughout the blastema, but what makes these distal cells different is their expression of A13. Okay? So that puts the two boundaries in the correct relationship for intercalation in the proximal distal axis. Okay, so now the question, how do those two boundary markers actually become separated? Here's the hypothesis, that the apical wound epidermis is responsible for establishing the distal boundary. And here's our experimental approach that we're going to take. We're going to determine the cellular pattern of expression of HOXA9 and HOXA13. Oh, I should have said, those experiments detecting that uniform expression were done on hole mounts. Okay? Hole mounts don't give you the resolution for you to be able to tell what the actual cellular pattern of expression is. And so we're going to have to examine the cellular pattern of expression of these two genes in normally regenerating limbs, and this is going to reveal how the expression domains are segregated. I'll show you in a moment why that's so. And then we're going to determine whether HOXA13 expression ceases in the absence of the apical wound epidermis, and then is regained when the wound epidermis is added back to the blastoma. Okay. So there are two possible modes of expression at the cellular level of HOXA9 and HOXA13. Here are the de-differentiating cells. The yellow here is the wound epidermis. And in case one, the subsets of cells are expressing A13, and another subset is expressing only A9. And then the way that these could become separated during growth of the blastema is that cells expressing A13 sort out to contact the epidermis. They have a greater affinity for the wound epidermis than they do for these A9 only expressing cells. So that's one way. But the other pattern of expression could be that every cell here is expressing both HOXA9 and HOXA13. Then it's just a matter of, as the blastema grows, those cells that maintain contact with the wound epidermis are the cells that will maintain expression of HOXA13 under factors that are emanating from that wound epidermis, most likely those FGFs I showed you in that slide. Eventually, these cells get out of range of those FGFs if they're diffusing, and then they can only express HOXA9. So in either way, you get your boundaries separated. So when we look at this, when we actually look at the patterns of expression, we'll be able to determine which one of these is correct. Then, I don't want to, how much time do I have here?
Supposed to wind up at 12.
Okay, so about 20 minutes? Okay. I'll just briefly, what we're gonna do, we're gonna go back and use the spin tunnel culture system to do this. So we're gonna put epidermis-free cone stage blastemas into these dorsal fin tunnels, either with the tip sticking out or fully enclosed in the tunnel. And of course, when you, well, we've been through all this. I explained all this. Let's go right on to the next slide. Okay, here's the experiment. Now, remember, you get this truncated pattern when you stick the blastema totally into the fin tunnel. And I said, well, that sort of suggests that the wound epidermis has a pattern-forming function in the PD axis, in addition to a growth function. But there's a caveat to that. It could be that the reason you get that truncated pattern distally is that when you have these blastemas immersed in a chelating agent and you strip off the epidermis, those cells are very sensitive to the effects of the chelating agent and they may die. They may simply die. And when you stick them down into the fin tunnel, the truncated pattern is due to the fact that those cells distally are wiped out. And in fact, in the chick embryo, for many years, you know, the original John Saunders experiments, removing the counterpart of this apical epidermal cap, the apical ectodermal ridge, showed the same kind of truncation pattern. The earlier you removed that ridge, the greater was the truncation. And then just 3 years ago, in Cliff Tabin's lab, they showed very clearly that the reason you got that pattern of truncation was that the distal 200 micrometers of cells died. So that was that. So we have to deal with that issue, and we're going to look at this, determining the percentage of apoptosis. We're going to do total cell counts, the percentage of cells in mitosis, and we'll also do now morphometrics, which have never been done, number of skeletal elements of each kind, their shapes, their lengths, all of this. Okay, and then our second experiment is HOXA13 expression suppressed in the absence of the wound epidermis. Is it restored by adding back the wound epidermis? And we're going to look at that in two ways. Even if the distal cells die in this experiment, those cells, if we stick the tip out of the tunnel, if they're dead, we're not going to see. Within a day or so after doing this, we're not going to see HOXA13 expression. But the fin epidermis is going to grow back over this thing, and that ought to bring that expression back if HOXA13, if the epidermis indeed is involved in the establishment of this distal boundary. But we have another way to look at it. This time, we'll put the blastema sticking out of the tunnel backwards. So this will be the proximal end that gets covered by this fin epidermis. This normally expresses only HOXA9 at this stage, the cone stage. And now we'll see if contact with the epidermis forces it to those cells to express HOXA13. Because we already know what happens when you do this experiment. You get this distally truncated set of parts here from this part of the blastema. But here, where the wound epidermis grows over it, you get another whole regenerate growing out of there. So you have two regenerates of opposite polarity. Okay, so that's the general idea of how we're going to look at this. Okay, now here's something that I've always found very interesting. Positional identity. What I want to show you is that positional identity is encoded in the cell surface. which is a kind of a logical assumption because that's the recognition method that these cells use. They have to touch in order to, or I'm going to show you that they touch. So this is something called the athenophoresis assay, and it was designed by Karen Crawford in my lab in the mid-1980s. It's a very clever thing. It's an in vivo assay, so I believe it, as opposed to most in vitro assays, which I don't believe. And here we have, here's the way it's done. She amputated the hind limb of an axolotl through the mid-femur, and P stands for posterior side. We're looking at the posterior side. Simultaneously, from other animals, she amputated four limbs at the level of the wrist, the elbow, and the arm, and she let them develop to a cone stage. She then, on different hosts, grafted those wrist, elbow, and upper arm blastemas to a wound bed made at the junction of the blastema and the differentiated tissues of the hind limb. So now we have these two undifferentiated blastemas sitting there like this. And then she just let this develop. And here's what happened. The upper arm blastemas stayed right there where they were put, at the level of the mid-femur. Okay? Those are corresponding levels, mid-upper arm, mid-femur. But the elbow blastema moved distally to articulate with the knee as it developed. And the wrist blastema moved even further distally to articulate with the tarsus as it developed into a hand. So here we have carpals to tarsals, elbow to knee, mid-upper arm to mid-femur. They move to the corresponding locations on the hind limb. They are separating out. It's like electrophoresis in a gel, except it's a live system that's doing it. So she showed by this means that there's a gradient of adhesivity down the length of the limb, and these blastemas will seek out that their corresponding level of affinity. Now, retinoic acid can simultaneously proximalize, posteriorize, and ventralize positional identity. Because of the time constraints, I'm not going to go through all of these things, but I'm just going to show you a couple. These are classic experiments. They were first done by Iqbal Niazi in India on Indian toads. Malcolm Maiden then did them on axolotls in London. And then we did some more on axolotls and also on newts. The results are all the same. When you amputate a limb through the level, the distal radius and ulna, and then 4 days after the amputation, when dedifferentiation is well underway, you inject the animal with a solution of retinoic acid. Retinoic acid dissolved in dimethyl sulfoxide because it's water insoluble. This little molecule, 300 molecular weight, has the ability to change the positional identity of these distal blastema cells. It proximalizes them. So this is a dose, this is 50 micrograms of RA per gram of body weight of the animal. And what you get is a little duplication of the distal ends of the radius and ulna. Okay? It's reset the positional identity here back to about 75 micrograms per gram of body weight. Here's the amputation site, distal radius and ulna. Now a complete duplication of the radius and ulna. It set the positional identity back to here. 100 micrograms per gram of body weight. Here's the amputation site, the distal radius and ulna. But now there's a shoulder girdle, a humerus, a radius and ulna, and a complete hand. A serially duplicated limb. It reset the positional identity of these distal radius and ulna cells all the way back to the shoulder. This essentially wrist-derived blastema thinks it's coming from the shoulder region. Now you can amputate this through here and do the same thing all over again and get another serially duplicated limb like that. Okay, proximalization of positional identity. Now, we didn't see, when we looked at these limbs initially, we saw no other effects on any other axis except the proximal distal axis. But actually, the effects are on all three axes simultaneously. Now, I'm just going to show you a couple of things here. The way you can reveal this is by making symmetrical limbs, double anteriors and double posteriors. And this is how they're made. You can make them either at the level of the upper limb or the lower limb. And this just shows how you do it on hind limbs. You simply cut right up through the middle if you're going to do it on the lower limb, and then you exchange the anterior and the posterior halves to make double anterior or double posterior. Up here, the way you do it is you take the anterior muscles and connective tissue from one side and exchange it with the muscle and connective tissue from the other side to make double anterior and double posterior limbs. These constructs regenerate a little bit differently from one another. So let's look at the ones that were made here. Double anterior, double posterior. This is a double anterior zygapodium after amputation. It doesn't fail to regenerate, but remember that picture I showed you of the longitudinal one-third regenerating a single digit and a single zygapodial element? That's what this thing is doing here. It's regenerated. Here's the femur here. Remember, the double anterior was made down here in the zygapodium, so there are twin tibiae here as a result of that operation. The amputation was about here, and what's regenerated is a single digit. And you get the distinct impression here that there's been some convergence. But nevertheless, in this one digit, this is complete in the proximal distal axis. And here is the histology. This was on a forelimb, so this was a double radius as a skeleton in here. Here's the blastema that's formed like this. Already you can see that this is symmetrical. And there's the single digit again, that a result of that regeneration. What about making a double anterior in the upper part of the limb? Well, now all you get is this cone of cartilage sticking out like this. And this kind of thing has been explained in a number of ways, but I'm going to add a new twist to this in a moment. This is double posterior limb, double posterior zygapodium now, lower one. This is a four limb, so they're twin ulnae here as a result of the operation. But look how much better the regeneration is. Now you get three digits. A digit 4, a digit 3, and a digit 4. Okay? Now, if it were perfect, remember again that picture I showed you originally, three digits coming from the anterior two-thirds of the blastema. Well, this is very similar here. You get two digits here. This one is most likely a fusion of two digit threes along the midline. So it's 3, 4, 3, 4. And here's one made on the hind limb, so this has a double fibula here. And now here's digit 5 and digit 4, and they're sort of fused along the midline. And here's another one that was done. This was done on the upper hind limb, double posterior. Now instead of just getting this cone of cartilage that you got with the double anterior, you get a digit 3, 4, and 5 symmetrically arranged around two fused digit threes right here in the middle. So these regenerate real well, these double posteriors, as opposed to the double anteriors, which regenerate much less. And what I actually want to propose is that they're just doing what their normal fate in the blastema is. This thing, you know, double the Most of the regenerant comes from the posterior two-thirds of the limb. So that's why you're able to get all these digits, both in constructs from the upper limb or the lower limb, and you get this one digit from a double anterior, and then in the upper limb, you only get a cone cartilage. That's because the pattern probably converges at the tip of that outgrowing blastema. And I want to ask another question now. We go back to this. This has always been interpreted as being truncated distally. Looks that way. All that's here, you'd say, well, that's nothing but a piece of femur cartilage that's regenerated here. You can put a different interpretation on this. That is because the anterior part of the limb contains so few of the positional identities of the whole regenerant that the pattern converges very quickly as this grows out into this tapering outgrowth. And you saw that in the zygapodial constructs, that convergence toward the midline. So I'm wondering if this out here, it really isn't the tip of the digits fused together. Everything just fused together in the midline. And one way to look at this fairly easily, I think, would be to use those HOXA9, HOXA13 products as markers, and then we could see if any of that is expressed during the growth of this blastoma. Okay, I'm not going to go through this. Double dorsal and double ventral zygapodia, you can make those two, and you can make them on the upper arm. They regenerate okay. They're hypomorphic. Each one regenerates a mean of about three digits. I don't care about that. What I'm really interested in is this. What happens if you treat a double anterior limb and a double posterior limb with retinoic acid? Okay, so this is what reveals the fact that retinoic acid posteriorizes as well as proximalizes the positional identity of blastema cells. This is a double anterior construct. A few days after amputation and treatment with retinoic acid, twin blastemas forming here. Growth of those twin blastemas, and now differentiation into two limbs that are complete in the anterior-posterior axis. They're mirror images. They're also duplicated in the proximal distal axis. And that's the hole now showing this. Here are these two limbs that are mirror images. This is a supernumerary back here that grows out where the, when you make the construct and make it symmetrical, there's a confrontation back here near the elbow region. And that gives you a supernumerary. So notice these are duplicated in the proximal distal axis. They're mirror images of one another. Retinoic acid has restored completely the ability of this double anterior construct to form a normal pattern. By that, what that means, has to mean, is that it has somehow posteriorized those cells so that you now have the complete circumference of the limb. Double posterior, though, is a totally different story. These things fail to regenerate completely. And a thick basement membrane grows under the wound epidermis, and all you get is a mass of scar tissue. The reason for that is completely posteriorizes the positional identity of those cells. There aren't any circumferential or radial disparities at all, so the whole thing just shuts down. Okay, now there are other ways you can interpret this, and here's Hans Meinhardt's interpretation, which does not conflict at all with ours. What he's proposed is that you need two boundaries that intersect in these regenerating limbs. And the way this is depicted, this is the posterior side of a normal limb over here, and here this dorsal part of the limb is different from the ventral part of the limb, and this posterior part right here is different from this anterior part. And this is known now to be true on a molecular level. This part represents the ZPA, the zone of polarizing activity. That zone secretes a signal, sonic hedgehog, that's important for development of the anterior-posterior axis. This boundary divides dorsal from ventral, and the gene that's expressed here is LMX1. That confers dorsal properties on these cells, and GRAIL is the gene that's expressed in the ventral side that confers ventral properties. So what happens when you make a double posterior limb? That's this construct. You've got these intersections, and it actually gives you four compartments in each place here. That grows out perfectly well. In my interpretation, that it gives you enough positional identities to keep the process of to prevent the process of convergence of pattern. But look what happens then when you make double anteriors. You don't have that. You don't have these intersections that what you need, and then you tend to get that convergence of pattern. This is just shows you the ZPA. This is expression of sonic hedgehog from paper of Endo et al. In 1997 on the posterior side of the limb. Well, we don't have to go through these, but that I was just going to show you that actually double anterior constructs can undergo intercalary regeneration perfectly well. What I want to show you now is this. Go back to Karen Crawford's aphenophoresis assay. She did the same experiment, wrist, elbow, and upper arm blastemas that were treated now with retinoic acid in order to proximalize the positional identity of the cells. Did the same kind of graft to the mid femur of regenerating hindlimb. The retinoic acid completely abolished the distal movement of the wrist and the elbow blastemas. Now all these blastemas, wrist and elbow blastemas and upper arm, all stayed in the same place. They didn't move. So that means that retinoic acid is coordinately proximalizing positional identity and cell affinity at the same time. So that's what leads to the conclusion that there's a code on the cell surface for positional identity. And these are just some actual pictures of what happens. This is going to be, I think, the next to the last slide. Jeremy Brocks then picked this up in the late 90s. This was another assay that James Nardi and I had developed at the University of Illinois. It was based on Malcolm Steinberg's differential adhesion hypothesis. What Steinberg would do is he would dissociate two different types of cells like chondrocytes and neural retina and mix them together in culture, or juxtapose two different kinds of tissue. And what happened under those circumstances is that the cells would sort out from one another. And it turns out that it's the cells that have the strongest adhesion to one another that wind up in the center. They are engulfed by the weaker adhering cells on the outside. So we use this as an assay for adhesion of proximal and distal blastemas, and that's what Jeremy did as well. So the protocol for the experiment is to take a distal blastema and juxtapose it to a proximal blastema in vitro. In the controls, the proximal blastema engulfs the distal blastema, meaning that the gradient of adhesion is highest distally and goes lower proximally. Then he had done a screen of genes that whose activity was upregulated twofold or more by retinoic acid. And he discovered one gene that was upregulated in this way that was a cell surface. It was CD59, it's a complement protein. And he named this PROD1, PROD1, which stands for proximodistal 1. And then this gene, CD59 or PROD1, is anchored to the cell surface by phosphatidylinositol linkers. So he used phospholipase C or an antibody prod one in this culture system, that abolished the engulfment behavior completely, suggesting that this molecule is involved in this positional identity code. Well, okay, what can be measured and modeled then in the system? A lot has already been done. Hans has done a lot of modeling in regenerating limb systems, but here are some things that I might suggest. Just shape changes of the blastema as it forms, grows, and is patterned and undergoes morphogenesis into the different limb segments. There has been no mathematical description whatsoever of these changes in shape. You can do this on sections at intervals, and at the same time you can look at mitosis and apoptosis as a function of location within the blastema and the stage of development. You can look at the pattern of cell density change as the blastema grows and changes shape. You can look at cell motility in blastema formation and morphogenesis. Things like skin contraction, migration of blastema cells toward the from the periphery toward the center, which has been claimed, but I've never seen any experiments that actually demonstrate it. Radial intercalation. Does something like convergent extension play a role in morphogenesis here? Even in these, the formation of these miniature regenerates, that might be a movement that helps shape this this miniature regenerate. And then boundary formation and intercalation. And the last thing, which I didn't put on here, but which I think a paper from our center will appear shortly in Developmental Dynamics, is modeling of gene networks in regeneration. We've done a lot of subtractive screening and come up with just literally thousands of genes that are involved in this process. So that can be modeled as well. Okay, so as Forrest Gump says, that's all I have to say about it.